8, we begin to move into the very final phase of their courtship. This final stage of courtship, which leads towards the goal of marriage, is a period of engagement. We're pretty familiar in our culture with engagement. In fact, engagement is a much more pronounced period of time than it was in biblical times. The period of betrothal in biblical times was very, very different. It was not uncommon during the time of, let's say, Jesus Christ. If you were to be betrothed to a woman, you would actually move into her house. Can you imagine such a thing? You would move into her home for a period of time, usually 4 to 6 months. You would move in and you would assist her father in whatever trade he was in. You would live under his home. You would live under his rule and under his observation. There was nowhere to hide. And there was no messing around with his daughter either. Everything was kept out in the open. Living quarters were usually very, very tight. We have an engagement period of our own, a period of betrothal, a time when a guy gets down on one knee and asks a woman to marry him. That period is known in our culture as engagement. I believe that an engagement is a short period of time, no more than 6 months. I don't say that because I'm trying to ruin anybody's life. If you're in an engagement that's been going on for 8 months, 10 months, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, I am not criticizing your approach. I'm just saying that the successful engagements that I have observed in our culture remain at 6 months or less. I was talking to a friend this last week, and she said, we courted for a while, and my curfew was, 11 o'clock at night during our courtship. And when we got engaged, my parents backed up my curfew to 9 o'clock, 2 hours. I didn't understand it at the time, but now you understand it, don't you? Because that period of engagement is that final slippery step before you get married. And it is easiest to fail during that particular time. An engagement is that short period of time where the couple officially announce their intent to be married and plan for their wedding ceremony and plan for their honeymoon. And I want to talk a little bit about that this morning. I will say that I got some great input both weeks. This is great. I've gotten a lot of input about the sermon series that we are doing. This last week, I got a lot of input, particularly from young people. Now, I will, not name names or anything, but there were several younger people that kind of came to me and said, so what you're saying is that the dating period needs to be rather short, and then the courtship, that's not supposed to be prolonged, that's supposed to be kind of short, and then you believe that the engagement's supposed to be kind of, what do you expect me to do, not date or something? That's stupid. I'm not going to do that. Wait, you're asking me to like commit social suicide out there. I can't possibly go through my life without dating somebody. And I just want to remind you, somebody also said to me, Chris, I don't think that the dates that you attach to all these things, I don't think they're biblical. You can't show me a chapter and verse that says, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, 8 months, that kind of thing. So I don't accept any of those things that you had to say. And so let me address that just really, really quick. I have no problem, first off, with your disagreement. Sometimes I disagree with myself, which is a painful process for me. And I have lots of arguments in my office. My secretary will attest to that. But I expect you, and I expect me, to base what we do in this life on biblical wisdom. In other words, the Bible has a lot of things to say on a principle level about the way that we should conduct our relationships. And I expect that whatever you decide to do, whether you decide to be engaged for 6 months or 6 years, that you will have a real solid biblical reason for doing what you're doing. It is not enough, in other words, to just simply disagree with somebody and throw the baby out with the bathwater. I would rather offer up to you, if you have a different idea, if you have a better idea, then let's interact about that. I am fully open to the idea that your ideas will refine mine, and perhaps we will both arrive at a higher achievement of what would be a holy walk with God for you. And remember, that is what we are holding up at the highest level. We are holding up that Christian relationships are to be distinctive in our culture. And that these relationships are actually showing people an example, a metaphor, if you will, of what Christ's relationship to the church is like. And so if what you're saying is that the way that our culture approaches relationships is perfectly fine for people in the church, I want to push up against that and say that I find that the way that the culture is approaching relationships shows a lack of wisdom, biblical wisdom, not just smarts, but biblical wisdom. And to push up against that, I would rather challenge you and say, show me from Scripture where the things that you do and the things that you say and the things that you share and the places you go and the times that you spend and the amount of time that you spend doing whatever it is you're doing, show me where these things reflect biblical wisdom. Why would I say that? Probably one of the most telling passages in all of the Bible about what a marriage should look like is found in Ephesians chapter 5. If you've got your Bibles, turn there right now. Ephesians chapter 5. If you didn't bring a Bible this morning or you left it in the car, we've got Bibles that are provided for you right in the book rack in front of you. Open them up to Ephesians chapter 5. Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. It's right back there in all those smaller books. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15. Hear me out on this. It says, therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time, because the days are evil. So then do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Do not get drunk with wine, for that is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks for all things in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ to God, even the Father, and be subject to one another in the fear of Christ. Paul lays this foundation for us of what our relationships should look like, and he starts it out with the comment, be wise. Observe the days that they are evil. Observe the culture that we live in, that it is corrupt. And you walk differently. Be wise. We all want to take verses and turn them into the law in our lives. We want a verse that says, I'm supposed to wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning and get going with my day. We want a verse that says I should go to sleep at 10 o'clock at night so that I can get enough rest for the next day. We want a verse that says I'm supposed to read my Bible 10 minutes a day in order to have a sufficient quiet time with God. We want a verse that's going to say this is how far is too far in a relationship before I get married. And we want a verse that tells us how many times we should be sexually intimate with our wives or husband after we get married. We want verses that guide our lives. And the Bible at all stations refuses to give that to us and rather says live with wisdom. Live in a way that expresses these basic principles, the grace of God to one another. Does that mean the Bible has nothing to say? The Bible has nothing to say about what is right and wrong? Absolutely not. Were those things clearly needed comment from God on which way was right? Those things were commented on. But the lion's share of our lives are spent living in wisdom. There's whole books of the Bible dedicated to wisdom literature. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, even the book that we are studying, the Song of Solomon. Wisdom literature. How we should live in a principled way. It doesn't mean that it's right in every single situation, but it means that generally speaking, this is a wise way to live. And by the power of the Holy Spirit inside of each Christian's life, we should be able to seek out what is a wise way to live in our culture. And we know this, that that wisdom should look differently than the evil of our day and the corruption of our day. So wherever you're at, in whatever relationship you are in, please do not be troubled. Do not be troubled with dates and times, 3 months, 6 months, 8 months. Do not get all worked up about these things. I would rather ask you, what is wise? What is wise in your relationship? And let's interact with that. I've thrown out the gauntlet. I've laid down what I believe are truly good principles based on a lot of years of working with couples and working with people that are in relationships and seeing the dating, the courtship, and the engagement periods. So you take that as maybe a beginning point and then be challenged. What will you do with that? Remember that part of our goal here too is to say that we are beginning habits in dating, in courtship, and in engagement that are supposed to last for the whole of our marriage relationship. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. But those of you that are married, that are perhaps feeling a little detached from how you're supposed to act during engagement, remember that these are principles that are supposed to be present in your relationship too. It should not be hard for the couples that are engaged in our church to figure out how to do these things. All they need to do is look at you, married people. They need to look no further than you. You are a living epistle, a living story, a living letter of how Jesus Christ is to be exampled through marriage in the church. Live by wisdom. There is no more foolish person than the one that says, I can do this on my own. I don't need any example. I'll make it up as I go. By God's grace, my daughter will never date anybody like that. By God's grace, she will date, both of my daughters will date, a man that shows wisdom. Who should become engaged? Letter B. A couple who are prepared to reflect the principles that I just began reading in Ephesians 5, 15 through 6, 4. This kind of a couple is ready to be engaged. Some of you are sitting on that brink of when am I ready to, you know, kind of bite off the next chunk of relationship? When am I ready to be engaged? What does engagement look like? Well, how is it different than courtship and that kind of thing? And so I would lay this out for you. The couple that shows success in Christ-like courtship through patient development of their relationship. In other words, they are not in some sort of a rush. They are not trying to create false intimacy by staying out with one another till 3 o'clock in the morning, 6 nights a week. How could you not like the person that you're staying out with till 3 in the morning, 6 nights a week? It's all you know. It's all you're doing. It's all you're living and breathing and eating. Of course, in that kind of immersion, you are going to feel a real tight sense of intimacy with that person. But could it be a false intimacy? Remember what the Word says. Be careful how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise. Make the most of your time, for the days are evil. Make the most of your time. Be patient in your application of your relationship. Great relationships happen in a crock pot, not a microwave. There's a simple way in our culture of thinking about it. Great relationships happen in a crock pot. The best marriages are the ones that have been around for a very long time. Man, those are the marriages that I really listen carefully to what those people have to say about marriage, about what works. And you bet that I ask them. And you bet that Melinda asks them. And if I miss something, Melinda mentions it to me. Believe me. And if I, you know, same back the other way. Number two, a couple who are prepared for a healthy departure from parental authority. Remember right at the very beginning, God said, this is the reason a man and a woman shall leave their parents. They are to leave their parents and cleave to one another. Now we get all excited about the sexual intimacy part of the cleaving. We're like, yeah, cleaving, that sounds like a good deal. We should emphasize more the leaving parental authority. While we are still called to honor our parents, the new family leaves and cleaves. There is a separation that occurs. There is a moment even. Today at 5 o'clock, I get to do Juliet Dobbs and Scott Palomaki's wedding. Gary May is walking Juliet down the aisle. And there will be a time at about 5:15 today that I will stand there, and Gary will be standing there with Juliet, and Scott will be standing next to me. And I will ask the question, who gives this woman to be wed to this man? And when Gary reaches out his hand to Scott and shakes his hand, he is going to take Juliet's arm, and he is going to hand her arm over to Scott. And there is a symbolic passing of the torch that moves from one family to the new family. And those two, this new couple, approach the altar together to be married in front of God and everyone else. And they will share vows, and they will exchange rings, and they will make promises to the Lord and to one another. And they will seal them, and then they will kiss, and they will turn around, and for the very first time in their lives, they will be introduced as a married couple. Why do we go through all the pomp and circumstance that surround weddings? Because it symbolizes exactly what I'm talking about here. That when a marriage occurs, God is not just bringing two into one. He is creating a family. All you need for a family are a mother and a father. You don't need kids. A family is created when two people get married. That's the beginning of the family. And that family is established not by me saying, you know, by the power vested in me. I mean, that's a legal thing, right? It's established by God. Where God once saw two people, He now sees one. These two people have moved out from under the authority of their parents. The parents that they still need to honor. And they are now, as a couple, she has been passed under the protection and the security of her husband. There's something magnificent and beautiful in this leaving and cleaving. The Bible even goes so far as to say that this is an example of Christ's relationship to the church. That this mystery of the handoff is one of the most distinctively Christian things that we do. And yet we live in a day and age where we want things to be so even, Stephen. We don't want to say that women submit and respect their husbands and that men lead and are giving themselves to their wives as Christ gives Himself to the church. We're so shy about saying those kinds of things because we don't want to imply that there's any kind of order to the marriage. We just want to say that everybody's the same. Everybody's roles are equal. And I got to tell you, your role is not equal to God's. God's role is not equal to Christ's. The man's role is not equal to the woman's. The wife's role is not equal to the husband's. The children's role are not equal to their parents. There is no equality in all of these things. There is the same value. There are different roles. To mix up the two things is to butcher the marriage relationship. And hear me out on this. I want to unpack that just a little bit in this next section. One thing that I will say that I found to be very important in this leaving and cleaving, what kind of a couple should get engaged? It's a couple who can successfully become financially independent. And by that I mean from their parents. There is nothing that is more of a cancer to a new relationship than constantly having to go back to mom and dad and borrow money. It causes tension between a couple. And a couple should be able to be financially independent, able to stand on their own financial feet in order to establish themselves. That's a tall order, isn't it? In a day and age where the median house price in Southern California is like $575,000. It seems insane that anybody would be able to just walk out at the beginning of their lives and be able to purchase a home like that. So we are looking at a very, very different sense of what stable is. But whatever that is going to translate into for a couple, I believe that part of leaving and cleaving is the ability to be financially independent. And dads, if a man comes and asks you, can I have your daughter's hand in marriage? This certainly would be probably on the list of things that you should ask. Do they have the ability to be financially? We shouldn't feel badly about that. Because I'll tell you what, when my daughter marries another man, she is no longer under my authority. She is no longer in my pocketbook. That's it. It's not to say that I will not support them. It is not to say that there will not be lavish gifts to the two of them. All right? I love my kids. I'll always love my kids. It is to say that there are no strings attached. It is to say that they are an independent couple, a family. That's not my doing. That is established by God, and I must respect it. Parents, we need to respect those things about the new couples that are being established in our church. Younger couples, understand, this is fully an expectation that you leave and cleave. I know there's a bonus to the whole cleaving thing, but there's more to the leaving part. A couple, number four, that is led by a man who enthusiastically loves his future bride as Christ loves the church. In other words, sacrificially. Take a look at Ephesians chapter 5, starting in verse 22. These verses will give the basis for what I'm saying here. Wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, He Himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself up for her, so that He might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the Word, that He might present to Himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one has ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of His body. There's the leave and cleave verse in verse 31, hearkening back to Genesis 2. For this mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church, he says in verse 32. Where does it start? It's led by a man who enthusiastically loves his future bride as Christ loves the church. It's sacrificial. He is willing to die for her. I have never met a woman that resists following someone who is willing to die for her. I've met many women that will resist a guy that kind of loves her, that mostly loves her, who has affairs with sports and his buddies and other commitments, and she's a part of the pie, maybe even a big part of the pie, but she knows for sure that she is not being loved the way that Christ loved the church, sacrificially. The question I will have for a guy that wants to marry my daughter is simply, have you lived in such a way that you show me with good confidence that you would be willing to die for my daughter? How's that? How's that for conversation? Guy better be loaded. I really believe there's two stages here. You know, there's one that's courtship, and there's one that's engagement. I think a young man should go to the father of the girl on both occasions. For courtship, he's coming to her and he's saying, I would like to court your daughter. I would like to court her with the intention of potentially finding out whether or not we should be married. And this is my promise to you. My promise to you is that I will not lay a hand on your daughter ever in an inappropriate manner. I will never do it. My commitment to you is that I will respect her and I will not lay a hand on her. We talked about that last week, the purity and the restraint that is shown in the courtship relationship. That's the kind of guy that most men would feel comfortable, a little bit, I'm still loading my gun, but it seems somewhat comfortable, right, dating their daughter. And when you're coming for that moment where you're asking for her hand in marriage, I think it should be communicated the biblical truth that the reason that I want to date your daughter is, or the reason I want to marry your daughter is this, and I'm willing to sacrifice for her, sacrifice all of it for her. Because that's what it is. When a guy hands off his daughter to that man, I guarantee you there isn't a father alive that won't die for his daughter, that won't die for his family. I mean, I would die for my little girls. I would die for my wife. And if I'm going to hand one of them away to another guy, he better be committed to that. He better be on board with what it says in Scripture. And guys, if you're taking the arm of another woman, just know that's the call. The call is for you to be as Christ to this woman, to sacrificially love her. And the way that you prove that is by not laying a hand on her and treating her in all those ways that we talked about at the beginning, all those character principles, all of those commitments that we make up to this point. That's how we show it. What is the woman's role in this? It's where the woman respects and joyfully submits to her future husband as unto the Lord. In other words, she is responsive. She is a responsive woman to her husband. A woman who willingly participates in spiritual matters with her future husband. See, the man is the one who is supposed to initiate spiritually with his future bride. He is supposed to engage spiritually with his future bride. Is there anything that is more desired in Christian relationships than a couple that engages one another spiritually? When I talk to young couples, they talk about that in such reverent terms. I want someone that I can pray with. I want someone that I can read the Bible with. I want someone that I can talk about Jesus with. I want someone that I can live my Christian life, you know, with someone else, in tandem, running together. And how often in Christian relationships does this just disintegrate, fall apart? There is no praying together. There is no reading together. There is no talk of Jesus. We talk about the bills, TV, and the kids more than we ever talk about Jesus Christ. And this is to our shame. Because men, we are supposed to be the ones that are initiating spiritually in the family. And women are supposed to be the ones that are willingly participating, getting engaged in spiritual matters, not resisting, but rather joining in and becoming a part of. This is the picture, one that is summed up magnificently, I believe, in verse 33 of Ephesians 5. If this is not highlighted in your Bible, you ought to underline it, highlight it, circle it, whack it against your head until it stamps onto you. This is such an important verse for relationships. Nevertheless, Paul says, each individual among you is to love his own wife even as himself. Love your wives, men. And women, the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. If you want the capstone verse for that whole section, if you want the, this is what it means. I said a whole lot of things. Some of it's kind of mysterious. Some of it doesn't make a lot of sense. This is what it means. It means this. Gentlemen, love your husbands. Whoa! Gentlemen! We're going to need to edit that one out. So good, too. I had the bold voice going and everything. I'm really quite excited about how I said that. Gentlemen, love your wives. Wives, respect your husbands. It is no more crystal clear than that verse. When a couple has done these things, and finally, let's not miss chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. It moves from the marital relationship of love and respect, and it moves into children. Most of the couples that I know that are getting married would like to have children. And if God so blesses, you should be able to provide a Christ-centered home for kids. I tell couples all the time, there's a few things that I tell couples, but one of them is, you should walk into your marriage, maybe not, you know, wanting to have kids right away, but ready to have kids, if God blesses you. We live in a day and age of birth control where things like that can be postponed, and no matter what your view is on some of those different things, you ought to be prepared. Because God is at work in creating people. and He doesn't pay much attention, I don't believe, to birth control. He wants you to be pregnant with your husband or wife. You're going to get pregnant. Just like that. This room's full of surprises. You can just take that thing that we call a surprise and just go, fingerprint of God right there. He's still in control over that aspect of our lives. We have not made nearly enough progress on this, but letter C at the top of the next page, there's a parental blessing before engagement that I think is absolutely critical. We'll talk more about that in a couple of weeks. But you even see it in Solomon's ceremony that The parental blessing was a key part of the ceremony itself. It's symbolic of the authority of the father over his family. A man should ask the father of the girl for her hand in marriage as a recognition of God's plan of leaving and cleaving. I am, in other words, not in favor of asking a girl to marry you and then checking with her parents later. That seems to be disrespecting the created order of things. So, gentlemen, take note. Ladies, just don't say yes. Simple. Did you ask my dad? No. No. You know. Love to marry you, but not yet. You got to talk to dad. Did you know he owns a gun? Okay. Remember, at each point in the process of any relationship, the goal is to develop habits and practices which last a lifetime. Behaving one way to win the guy or the girl, and a whole different way once married, is a great recipe for disaster. We're going to talk a lot about that next week. We're going to talk about servanthood. And next week's sermon is entitled Giving Away Your Crunchy Apple. And I'm really excited about talking about servanthood next week. But in business, if you did this kind of thing, it would be called fraud. And I think it's the same thing in a marriage relationship. Some of you were dazzling when you dated. You've kind of fallen off the face of the earth since then. And I would encourage you to return to the person who created the environment for his wife, and wives responded to that environment that was so dynamic and exciting within the dating relationship. How important is that? It's huge. It's critical. So important that I strongly encourage you to have a date night. I realize we live in a world of jobs and kids and activities and school and sports and all that stuff. Do you have a sacred night that is just for you and your bride or for you and your man? I mean, just a sacred night to date the one you're with. See, these are not habits that we just kind of make up for this one period of our lives and we chuck them and we try to make up something else once we're married. If there's one thing that marriage has proven to me, it does not mean that you get to spend more time with each other. Nothing in this world is working to preserve marriage. Not our government, not our culture, not sometimes even our church. We need to become a church and a culture within Long Beach Alliance Church that is contributing to the togetherness of families and calling them to higher things. Well, jumping back to the Song of Solomon at this point, I want you to see that in verse 8, the Shulamite girl, who is living in great anticipation of Solomon coming to her to receive her for marriage, and he's asking for her hand, she knows that it's coming, but she doesn't know when. You know, it's a funny thing. Have you ever gone to buy a magazine rack? I was at Barnes & Noble a couple of weeks ago. They've got an entire section of wedding magazines for women. I mean, one after another after another. There's brides, there's wedding gowns, there's these girls dressed in these fabulous dresses on the front, all white and on these exotic locations, getting married on the beach in Fiji. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And there's a huge rack of them. You know what's nowhere in that rack? Grooms. Not a single magazine for guys in there. Not even one. You know why? Because we don't care. I hate to burst anybody's bubble. If you are currently engaged and you're talking to that guy and he seems like, oh, what a great listener. Remember that video. I leaned over to my wife and said, I just want you to know I never did this to you. And she looked at me with like, yeah, whatever. You actually did that to me while I was sitting there. We see this engagement story in the Song of Solomon through the Shulamite's eyes. Why is that? Because women truly are invested in the anticipation of a marriage. Men are truly invested in anticipation of a honeymoon. Truth be told, The guy is looking toward the marriage and the consummation of the marriage, and the women are fully experiencing everything that leads up to it. Now, the two things work together. I don't mean to separate them so that they are different. The two actually do work together. But understand, women are responding to the anticipation, the romance, the environment. Guys love the fruits of marriage, which come with the wedding night. That's why there are no wedding magazines for guys. It's not interesting. If I ever saw a guy reading a groom's magazine, I'd think, what's wrong with him? That's weird. I can remember my wife showing me guys in the wedding magazines, though, like, oh, look at this tux. This would look nice, and that kind of thing. But they don't make that stuff for the guys. Why? Nobody would buy it. See, the Shulamite girl is going through this great anticipation. Let her be. She's experiencing increasing desire. She even imagined Solomon. Look at verse 9. If this isn't like a verse that you would think is of a stalker. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Those were romantic words back in that time. Behold, he is standing behind our wall. He is looking through the windows. He is peering through the lattice. Okay, that's when you call the cops, all right? Just, guys, don't try this, all right? That means different back then than it does now. She is, this whole sequence that she is going through here, it's through her eyes. This isn't necessarily something that he has done. This is just through her eyes. She is anticipating. She has increasing desire for him. She wants him to be around. She wants to talk to him. She wants to see him. She hears him, even though it's not him. She is anticipating what is coming. She is like the girl that calls the guy on the phone and says, what were you thinking about? And he foolishly says, I was thinking about our future. And boom, she's off and running. And he's thinking, how do I get this game on pause? You know? And that kind of thing. She has got great anticipation. Solomon, though, does arrive. And he romantically and respectfully asks the Shulamite girl to be his bride. Look at verses 10 through 13. This is, again, through the Shulamite's eyes. And she says, my beloved responded, and he said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. For behold, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers have already appeared in the land, the time has arrived for pruning the vines, and the voice of the turtle dove has been heard in our land. The fig tree has ripened, the vines are in blossom, they're giving forth their fragrance. Arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come along. What has passed? The winter time? What has come? The springtime. And that is when couples got married in Israel. They got married in the spring, much in the same way that couples kind of crank it into high gear in Southern California in, you know, about May all the way through August. I'm doing 6 weddings over the course of this summer, all happening in that little window right there. Just people get married during that window or near to that window. It's the same thing that's going on here. He's saying, the winter is gone, the cold of our relationship is over, and the spring is kind of the thaw has occurred. Things are blossoming, as is our love. He has put thought into his request, and eloquence has gone into his invitation. It is filled with romance. No woman wants to be asked to be married while watching SportsCenter and eating pizza. A woman wants to be asked with eloquence. A woman wants to be asked in a way that heightens the anticipation, that heightens the desire, that really is romantic. Guys, this is a good time in your life to think before speaking. This is a good time in your life to actually have a plan for asking a woman how to marry you. I'll tell you what, when guys get together and they find out a guy got engaged, it's all like, you know, hand clapping, high fives, way to go, good job. There's never a question, how'd you do it? What was it like? Tell me how you got down on one knee. I've never had a guy ask me any of those questions. You get a bunch of girls together, and it is like, it's like bugs around a light. I mean, it's just like, and they're all just like, tell me what he did. What was the look in his face? What was he wearing? What were you wearing? What did he get? Did he go right down? Oh, what did he say? I mean, it is just unbelievable. All the details and all the stuff. Guys, don't shortchange your girl. Don't leave her with a story that she kind of has to embellish to make up good things. Well, it was during a commercial. Solomon, as he speaks to her, compares their courtship to wintertime, but invites her to a relationship that is full of life, love, and abundance, one that looks like the spring. Top of the next page, Solomon speaks directly to his future bride, and he calls her a dove. My dove in the clefts of the rock, he says in verse 14. He shows her gentleness and understanding. She is shy at the proposition of becoming married to him, and he promises to protect and sacrifice for her well-being. In the secret place of the steep pathway, let me see your form. Let me hear your voice. From your voice, it is sweet. Your form is lovely. He assures her that he will protect her. Come out of the cleft of the rock. Perhaps even a call for her to come out from the relationship. Leave the relationship of your father in the cleft, the strength of the rock, and come into my care. I promise you, my dove, I will keep you safe. You are lovely to me. Your voice is sweet to me. And he calls her out from that. See, engagement is a time, letter F, of vulnerability and trust building. There are no place anymore for secrets or a hidden past history between a couple who is engaged to be married. If there has been anything left unsaid, in other words, it needs to be said, because secrets are a cancer to relationships and they will eventually kill. They will eventually just wipe out a relationship. If there are stones that need to be turned over and just say, I just need to tell you about something, then that's when those conversations need to happen. He is promising to protect her and sacrifice for her, to not ruin her vulnerability, to not betray her trust. Because why? Look at what it says in the next verses. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining the vineyards while our vineyards are in blossom. See, in that culture out in the fields, foxes would come into the vineyards, and right as the vineyards are going into bloom, they open up small petals. And on the inside of those petals is what eventually will become the grapes. And those grapes eventually will be cut and turned into wine and all the other viticulture products that come from the vine. But at the very beginning of the blossom, those little buds in the middle are just filled with sweet-tasting water. And so foxes would quickly run through and they would bite off those easy-to-see blossoms. And they would just go right down through the vineyard, jumping and biting off all of the blossoms. And so he says to her, there are little foxes that are in our vineyard. And so letter G on your outline, kind of unpack this a little bit. These little foxes are like the conflicts that occur during a time of courtship and engagement. They're small. They seem insignificant when you're engaged. Do you remember this, those of you that are married? The little things that you dealt with that you thought were huge, but they were small things that you dealt with, the little foxes that you dealt with during the engagement period. And you thought, oh, that's no big deal. And then you got married and you're like, oh, I guess it's a bigger deal. And then now you've been married for a while and you're like, no, that's a big deal, all right? Should have taken on that little fox a little more aggressively at the beginning. See, the things that are small during engagement, that are little conflicts, will become huge conflicts later. Make no mistake. Marriage is not the place for conflict. We need to deal with conflict. We need to have the ability to have great conflict resolution skills. We have to learn how to fight clean. Couples for generations have really missed out on this. That's why I'm such a huge proponent of premarital counseling. I think that couples should go through Christian premarital counseling. Why do I think that? Because couples that go through four or more sessions of premarital counseling reduce their chance of getting divorced from 49% to 25%. Four sessions. That's it. 4 hours. And you drop your chance of getting divorce down to 25%. If you go through six or more, you drop it down to 18%. Is it foolproof? Of course not. Is it wise? Yeah, it is. we ought to be people that come to our relationships with what I call a toolbox. And my hope is that in premarital counseling, you add tools to your toolbox to be able to develop great conflict resolution skills. There are so many things that can take us out in our marriages. Our whole world is set up to take out marriages. What is going to be distinctive about us? What will be distinctive about you? Finally, passion and purity for this engaged couple. The Shulamite girl, of course, says yes. She says, "My beloved is mine and I am his." She embraces him. He pastures his flock among the lilies until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away. "Turn, my beloved, be like a gazelle, a young stag on the mountains of Bether," or on the mountains that are spread apart. The Shulamite girl, in saying yes, she affirms the exclusivity of their love. She says it's reserved for the two of them, and she daydreams out loud of a time when their love will be able to be expressed between her. This is, again, part of that anticipation, part of that desire. Look at what it says in chapter 3, verse 1. It says that she's on her bed. In other words, she's going to sleep. It's nighttime. "And I sought him, whom my soul loved." What we have here is a dream sequence from the Shulamite girl. She's talking about what she's dreaming about now, and she's desperately looking for him. "I sought him, but I could not find him. I must arise now and go about the city and the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I could not find him. The watchmen who make the rounds in the city found me, and I said, 'Have you seen him whom my soul loves?' Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves." She is looking for him. She lives in great anticipation of her wedding day. I can't tell you how many times my wife called me at the time we were just engaged, and she would have us run back through once again, time and time again. "Tell me again why we're getting married. Tell me again about our love." And I would always take it as like, man, I'm just not being communicative enough. There is no way to be communicative enough. I saw a commentary written by a guy who asked his wife. He said this is the most confusing part of the whole book for him. He just didn't understand why she had this dream. And he was expressing this to his wife, and she laughed, and she said, "It's because you guys, you're independent. You know, stuff happens around you, just bounces off of you. You're just able to go your own way and make your own path." She says, "It's not the same for women. Getting married is a big deal. And when we're anticipating getting married and anticipating having a godly marriage and anticipating placing our lives under yours, That's a huge deal for us, and it feels scary. And it is vulnerability." And he says, "The first time I really understood that passage, when I understood the vulnerability that a woman experiences as she approaches her wedding day, as she approaches that altar, just how much she is depending on that guy." That's how the Shulamite girl is feeling here. She lives in that great anticipation. She dreams of her fiancé. She desires the security of marriage. She desires to give herself to her husband. Look at what she says. This dream gets a little bit edgy here in verse 4. "Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him. I would not let him go until I had brought him to my mother's house." Uh-oh. You know, that's not good. "And into the room of her who conceived me, I brought him to my house. I brought him to my mother's bed." I mean, you know what happens next, right? This is going to go south all of a sudden. And then look what it says. "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field," direct quote from chapter 2, verse 7, "that you will not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases." Even in the midst of this dream that she's having about him, there is restraint and there is purity that is shown in the midst of their relationship. So much a part of the DNA of who they are that even in her dreams, purity and restraint are in the forefront of her heart and mind. She's already experienced this in chapter 2, verse 7, and she dreams of Solomon protecting her purity, guarding her heart with the wedding day and the marriage in mind. And it reminded me again, you will never regret purity. You will always regret impurity. You will never regret making a pure effort, making doing pure actions in the midst of your relationships. You will always regret impurity. Well, all of these verses lead us to a place where the married couple is engaged, where the married couple is prepared to pursue their wedding. Next week, if we were to progress straight through this, we would hit the wedding and we would hit the honeymoon. I'm going to pause a week on that, though, because I want to back up and I want us to talk a little bit more next week about servanthood and serving one another in the context of our relationships. But I want you to see something that I think is so important, and it'll start our sermon in a couple of weeks. And it's in Song of Solomon, chapter 3, verse 6. Would you stand up as I read this and we close our service this morning? This is Song of Solomon, chapter 3, verse 6. What is this coming up from the wilderness, like columns of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all scented powders of the merchant? That view that they have right there in verse 6 is the beginning of the wedding ceremony. And those columns of smoke that the wedding party would have observed would have been symbolic of God's presence. You'll remember earlier in Israel's history, there was the pillar of fire. There was the cloud that followed around the nation of Israel. This pillar of smoke that would have streamed up into the air was symbolic for the Israelites of God's presence in the midst of the wedding ceremony. See, our goal in all of this is that people would observe God in the midst of our relationships. And my desire and my goal is to hold up a standard for our relationships that is so solidly biblical that it is actually going to reveal to the world around us God in the midst of our relationships. Like a pillar of smoke that cannot be missed. When you see a pillar of smoke around the community, you know that at the base of that there is what? Fire. Is that your relationship that you have? Does it burn for God? Does it show God off to the rest of the world? If you're like me, and Melinda and I were talking about this last week, she goes, man, you got to tell people, we don't have this kind of relationship you're talking about. People are going to think you're crazy. You know, all these different things. I struggle and fight through all the same stuff that everyone else in here does to have a good relationship with my wife. And God has given us a great marriage after 12 years. But I'll tell you what, it is work. But we want our neighbors, and we want our friends, and we want our community to see a marriage like a pillar of smoke that shows off God. And if you've got a relationship that's maybe just a wisp of smoke, or there ain't no fire at the base, then can I implore you and encourage you to just go back to the beginning, to go back to the characteristics and to the ingredients that make for a great dating relationship, courtship, and engagement, and revisit those things within the context of your marriage so that you will be able to have a relationship that everyone can look at and say, something different there. I see Jesus in the midst. The greatest weddings I get to do are the ones where God is present. The greatest weddings that I get to officiate are the ones that have got God's blessing all over them. Jesus just leaks off of them. Those are awesome weddings to be able to officiate. Is that the kind of relationship you have and that I have? Your homework assignment is to get together with your husband or your wife, with the person that you are courting or are engaged to, and to sit down with chapter 1, verse 1 through 3, verse 5, and just ask yourself, is this the kind of relationship we have? And if it's not, then you're like everyone else in the room. What are the things that God is calling you to do better in so that your relationship can represent God to the whole world. You are an encouragement not only to one another, but you are an encouragement to this whole church, to this family, and to the community that we live in. That's who we want to be.